unravelling of loins and ledger books, must stand at last darkened and dumb at the shore of a void without terminus or origin. And whatever science he might bring to bear upon the dusty primal matter blowing down out of the millennia will discover no trace of ultimate atavistic egg by which to reckon his commencing. I think that McCarthy is warning his reader that the judge is Moby Dick rather than Ahab. As another white enigma, the albino judge, like the albino whale, cannot be slain. Melville, a professed Gnostic who believed that some anarch hand or cosmic blunder had divided us into two fallen sexes, gives us a Manichaean quester in Ahab. McCarthy gives Judge Holden the powers and purposes of the bad angels, or demiurges, that the Gnostics called archons, but he tells us not to make such an identification, as the critic Leo Doherty eloquently has. Any system, including the Gnostic one, will not divide the judge back into his origins. The ultimate atavistic egg will not be found. What can the reader do with the haunting and terrifying judge? Let us begin by saying that Judge Holden, though his gladsome prophecy of eternal war is authentically universal, is first and foremost a Western American, no matter how cosmopolitan his background. He speaks all languages, knows all arts and sciences, and can perform magical, shamanistic metamorphoses. The Texan-Mexican border is a superb place for a war god like the judge to be. He carries a rifle mounted in silver with its name inscribed under the checkpiece, Et in Arcadia Ego. In the American Arcadia, death is also always there, incarnated in the judge's weapon, which never misses. If the American pastoral tradition essentially is the Western film, then the judge incarnates that tradition, though he would require a director light years beyond the late Sam Peckinpah, whose The Wild Bunch portrays mildness itself when compared to Glanton's paramilitaries. I resort, though, as before, to Iago, for only he is worthy to consort with Judge Holden. Iago, who transfers war from the camp and the field to every other locale, is a pyromaniac setting everything and everyone ablaze with the flame of battle. The judge might be Iago before Othello begins, when the war god Othello was still worshipped by his honest color officer, his ancient or ensign. The judge speaks with an authority that chills me, even as Iago leaves me terrified. This is the nature of war, whose stake is at once the game and the authority and the justification. Seen so, war is the truest form of divination. It is the testing of one's will and the will of another within that larger will, which, because it binds them, is therefore forced to select. War is the ultimate game, because war is at last a forcing of the unity of existence. If McCarthy does not want us to regard the judge as a Gnostic archon or supernatural being, the reader may still feel that it hardly seems sufficient to designate Holden as a 19th-century Western American Iago. Since Blood Meridian, like the much longer Moby Dick, is more prose epic than novel, the Glanton foray can seem a post-Homeric quest, where the various heroes or thugs have a disguised god among them, which appears to be the judge's Herculean role. The Glanton gang passes into a sinister aesthetic glory at the close of chapter 13, when they progress from murdering and scalping Indians to butchering the Mexicans who have hired them. They entered the city haggard and filthy, and reeking with the blood of the citizenry for whose protection they had contracted. The scalps of the slain villagers were strung from the windows of the governor's house, and the partisans were paid out of the all but exhausted coffers, and the Sociedad was disbanded, and the bounty rescinded. Within a week of their quitting the city, there would be a price of 8,000 pesos posted for Glanton's head. I break into this passage partly to observe that from this point on the filibusters pursue the way down and out to an apocalyptic conclusion, but also to urge the reader to hear and to admire the sublime sentence that follows directly, because we are at the visionary center of Blood Meridian. They rode out on the north road, as would parties bound for El Paso. But before they were even quite out of sight of the city, they had turned their tragic mounts to the west, and they rode infatuate and half-fond toward the red demise of that day, toward the evening lands and the distant pandemonium of the sun. Since Cormac McCarthy's language, like Melville's and Faulkner's, frequently is deliberately archaic, the meridian of the title probably means the zenith or noon position of the sun in the sky. Glanton, the judge, the kid, and their fellows are not described as tragic. Their long-suffering horses are. And they are infatuate and half-mad, fond, because they have broken away from any semblance of order. McCarthy knows, as does the reader, that an order urging the destruction of the entire Native American population of the Southwest is an obscene idea of order. But he wants the reader to know also that the Glanton gang is now aware that they are unsponsored and free to run totally amok. The sentence I have just quoted has a morally ambiguous greatness to it, but that is the greatness of Blood Meridian, and indeed of Homer and of Shakespeare. McCarthy so contextualizes the sentence that the amazing contrast between its high gestures and the murderous thugs who evoke the splendor is not ironic, but tragic. The tragedy is ours as readers, and not the Glanton gang's, since we are not going to mourn their demise, except for the kids, and even there our reaction will be equivocal. My passion for Blood Meridian is so fierce that I want to go on expounding it, but the courageous reader should now be, I hope, pretty well into the main movement of the book. I will confine myself here to the final encounter between the preternatural Judge Holden and the kid, who had broken with the insane crusade 28 years before, and now at middle age must confront the ageless judge. Their dialogue is the finest achievement in this book of augmenting wonders, and may move the reader as nothing else in Blood Meridian does. I reread it perpetually, and cannot persuade myself that I have come to the end of it. The judge and the kid drink together, after the avenging judge tells the kid that this night his soul will be demanded of him. Knowing he is no match for the judge, the kid nevertheless defies Holden with laconic replies, playing against the judge's rolling grandiloquence. After demanding to know where their slain comrades are, the judge asks, "And where is the fiddler, and where the dance?" "I guess you can tell me." "I tell you this, as war becomes dishonored and its nobility called into question, those honorable men who recognize the sanctity of blood will become excluded from the dance, which is the warrior's right. And thereby will the dance become a false dance, and the dancers false dancers. And yet there will be one there always who is a true dancer, and can you guess who that might be?" "You ain't nothing." To have known Judge Holden, to have seen him in full operation, and to tell him that he is nothing, is heroic.
"You speak truer than you know," the judge replies, and 2 pages later murders the kid, most horribly.
Blood Meridian, except for a 1-paragraph epilogue, ends with the judge triumphantly dancing and fiddling at once, and proclaiming that he never sleeps, and he will never die. But McCarthy does not let Judge Holden have the last word. The strangest passage in Blood Meridian, the epilogue, is set at dawn, where a nameless man progresses over a plain by means of holes that he makes in the rocky ground. Employing a 2-handled implement, the man strikes the fire out of the rock which God has put there. Around the man are wanderers searching for bones, and he continues to strike fire in the holes. And then they move on. And that is all. The subtitle of Blood Meridian is The Evening Redness in the West, which belongs to the judge, last survivor of the Glanton gang. Perhaps all that the reader can surmise with some certainty is that the man striking fire in the rock at dawn is an opposing figure in regard to the evening redness in the West. The judge never sleeps, and perhaps will never die, but a new Prometheus may be rising to go up against him. Ralph Ellison, Invisible Man. It seems reasonable to judge that the greatest aesthetic achievement by African Americans is the work of the major masters of jazz, Louis Armstrong, Charlie Parker, Bud Powell, and others. But then, jazz is the only indigenous American art. African American writers, despite critical confusions among some of their politicized academic cheerleaders, were in no position to found an original literary art. Invisible Man, 1952, by the late Ralph Ellison, remains much the strongest novel by an American black. And its palpable, and by Ellison acknowledged, debts are to Melville, Mark Twain, Faulkner, Dostoevsky, and to the poetic language of T.S. Eliot. Toni Morrison, though she passionately argues otherwise, is also a child of Faulkner, as well as of Virginia Woolf. Ellison was a writer of immense and mordant sensibility, and his pride at having composed Invisible Man was the largest single factor in his refusal to publish a 2nd novel during his lifetime. I urge the reader towards Invisible Man, and not to Juneteenth, edited from Ellison's manuscripts. I do not believe he would have sanctioned its publication. More than once, he had asked me if any American novelist, except for Henry James, had really composed a 2nd masterwork. Presumably, he was thinking of Melville, Twain, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, among others, and I would have been tactless to suggest candidates, and so did not. Yet he was well aware of Faulkner, who in his grand early phase had created The Sound and the Fury, As I Lay Dying, Light in August, and Absalom, Absalom. Faulkner, a Southern white, faced many cultural pressures, but nothing like those that bothered Ellison in the last quarter century of his life. Feminist critics, Marxists, and African-American nationalists complained of Ellison's insistence at setting art above ideology. Refusing polemic, the novelist partly withdrew into his massive dignity. There are essays galore, he commented upon some of them to me with ironical dismissal, that chide Ellison and his narrator-protagonist, Invisible Man, for not embracing the true political faith. Though Ellison, as the reader will see for herself, ends with an ambiguity tinged with hope, the typical condemnation is that Invisible Man will never come up from underground, because he lacks the black mother, black muse, or Marxist wiliness that could propel him back to society. Ellison wrote his own novel, and we do best to learn how to read it and why. Another age will come, with other cultural politics, while Invisible Man will retain the American and universal imaginative vitality with which Ralph Waldo Ellison endowed it. At Invisible Man's conclusion, the narrator again invokes Louis Armstrong, who throughout has been his chosen precursor, indeed his spiritual guide, Virgil to his Dante. And there's still a conflict within me. With Louis Armstrong, one half of me says, "Open the window and let the foul air out," while the other says, "It was good green corn before the harvest." In the prologue, Invisible Man listens to Armstrong playing and singing, "What did I do to be so black and blue?" and reflects, "Perhaps I like Louis Armstrong because he's made poetry of being invisible." Ellison, a deep student of Armstrong's work, understood that jazz changed from a music of the folk to a high art of innovation because of Armstrong. In some sense, Ellison transformed Charles Chestnut and Richard Wright, rather as Armstrong transcended his precursors in jazz, a movement from folklore to high modernism. Invisible Man is a historical novel because most of it takes place in the 1920s and 1930s, when the United States was hardly less racist a society than it had been in the 1870s and 1880s. Though we need not congratulate ourselves that much of what goes on in Ellison's novel could not happen now, it can and does. Public attitudes have altered to some degree, and the law at least is different. The book's brotherhood, the Communist Party, scarcely exists, and the remarkable Ross, the exhorter, has been replaced by the more mundane Reverend Al Sharpton. The even more remarkable Reinhardt, reverend and drug runner, has a host of contemporary equivalents, but here nature falls short of Ellison's art, and the exuberant Reinhardt remains larger than life. Invisible Man, Melvillian, Faulknerian, like Miss Lonely Hearts, The Crying of Lot 49, and Blood Meridian, shares the negative sublimity of all the novels I have been reading in this chapter, and shares also in their greatness. Kenneth Burke, most admirable of 20th-century American critics, several times in conversation urged me to meditate upon Ellison as the American master of the novel of education, the genre of the German Bildungsroman, of Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, and Goethe's Wilhelm Meister. Mann's novel, as we have seen, is a lovingly ironic parody of the genre, but Ellison's seems to me a demonic or tragic parody. His Invisible Man, in some respects, is closer to Dostoevsky's Underground Man than to a developmental hero of the Goethean, Mannian sort. Ellison himself cited Malraux, T.S. Eliot, Hemingway, Faulkner, and Dostoevsky as his literary ancestors. Interestingly, he excluded Moby Dick, which lends Invisible Man its crucial Jonah component. I suspect that Melville, like Faulkner, was a touch too close, while Dostoevsky was safely distant in place and in time. The hero of Dostoevsky's Notes from Underground suffers humiliations and narrates his subsequent rejection of the world, withdrawing to a hovel. This symbolic withdrawal is to some extent a rejection of Western values and ideas, though the underground man is well aware that European rationalism has an inescapable position in his own consciousness. But he rebels against it, profoundly believing that it violates his integrity. Ellison's Invisible Man is considerably more gifted than Dostoevsky's angry protagonist, and, as an African-American, he has a more complex predicament, Dostoevsky wanted to reject Europe. Ellison passionately refuses to give up on America, though his invisible man will not accept it upon its hypocritical terms. Moby Dick is haunted by the Book of Jonah, and so is Invisible Man. I don't know whether Melville knew that the Book of Jonah is read aloud to the congregation on the Jewish Day of Atonement, but Ellison certainly did. The Book of Jonah is not apocalyptic, but survivalist. Jonah, the evasive prophet, is resurrected from the belly of the whale after he has repented fleeing from Yahweh out of pique. Humor clearly dominates the Hebrew text, since Jonah's vexation against Yahweh is that the prophecy proved successful and the people of Nineveh turned away from evil, thus averting the city's destruction. The invisible man, like Jonah, is always in repression, to which Freud assigned the metaphor of fleeing. False Fathers, Bledsoe, Lucas Brockway, Jack of the Brotherhood, continually betray him, even as Jonah feels betrayed by God the Father, who declined to obliterate Nineveh. Chased by whites into a manhole, Invisible Man becomes Jonah in the whale's belly, thus beginning his underground existence, from which, as I read it, he is about to emerge as the novel concludes. The book's prologue, with its lyrical power, sweeps the reader downwards to a Dantesque vision, as Invisible Man, listening to Armstrong play and sing "What Did I Do to Be So Black and Blue," descends the levels of an African-American inferno. In his phantasmagoria, he hears a preacher taking as text the blackness of blackness, which touches its nadir in the Jonah motif of the whale's belly. "It'll put you, glory, glory, O my Lord, in the whale's belly." Covertly, Ellison alludes to Father Maple's great sermon on Jonah in Moby Dick, where each of us is adjured to be only a patriot to heaven. And yet, Ellison enforces the African-American difference. Blackness puts you in the whale's belly, and blackness alone is insufficient to resurrect you, though nothing American society offers is going to resurrect you either. Self-reliance, even if you are named for Emerson, will not send you out of the whale's belly, and yet it can change the nature of your sojourn. Invisible Man is as intricate and rich in texture as Moby Dick and As I Lay Dying, and the reader is best advised to take the book slowly and steadily, reading aloud to herself and others whenever the prose is richest. The rewards are immense. This is a novel that transcends politics and ideology, while never for a moment evading the Invisible Man's obligation to prophesy the destruction of the new Nineveh, the United States of America, unless it turns now away from the hatefulness of the final consequences of African-American slavery. Since his symbolic function is so dominant, the reader may slight the Invisible Man's personality and character, which would be a loss. Ellison, perhaps with an eye upon James Joyce's Ulysses, magnificently fuses naturalism and symbolism in his novel, rather as Faulkner, also influenced by Joyce, did in As I Lay Dying. Though necessarily nameless, Invisible Man's personality renders any name redundant. We hear his voice incessantly, ironic, eloquent, jazz-influenced, sometimes furious with outrage, yet always open to a vision that others yet might match his own humane sensibility. Perhaps he is the black Ulysses, on the implicit model of Joyce's Poldie, who abhors all violence and hatred. Far more of an outsider even than Poldie, the invisible man, to survive, answers violence with violence and hatred with fierce irony. A surrogate for Ellison, Invisible Man's cultural aesthetic is jazz. Ellison, with profound insight into jazz, defined it as a perpetual contest, a cutting in which each innovator transcends his forerunners while ironically incorporating them. That is the secret of the Invisible Man's language, and is the basis of the continuous stylistic splendor of Ellison's novel. Its narrative techniques and evolving styles have set a standard for what should be called novelistic jazz that no one else has been able to attain. The fusion of a jazz aesthetic with an essentially Faulknerian style made Invisible Man a book that remains unique, though Toni Morrison has come closest to Ellison's synthesis. There is a subtle polyphony that goes on throughout Invisible Man. The narrative line is clear, but something else frequently plays against it, as in the great epiphany of Reinhardt, holy man, pimp, drug racketeer, who appears in a cardinal's robe in front of his congregation under the gold rubric, "Let there be light." Backing away from Reinhardt's apotheosis, the Invisible Man, who has weathered nearly anything you can imagine, is shocked into the realization that Reinhardt and truth are one. It was too much for me. I removed my glasses and tucked the white hat carefully beneath my arm and walked away. Can it be? I thought. Can it actually be? And I knew that it was. I had heard of it before, but had never come close. Still, could he be all of them? Ryan the runner, and Ryan the gambler, and Ryan the briber, and Ryan the lover, and Reinhardt the reverend. Could he himself be both rind and heart? What is real, anyway? But how could I doubt it? He was a broad man, a man of parts who got around. Reinhardt the rounder. It was true as I was true. His world was possibility, and he knew it. He was years ahead of me, and I was a fool. I must have been crazy and blind. The world in which we lived was without boundaries, a vast, seething, hot world of fluidity. And Ryan the rascal was at home. Perhaps only Ryan the rascal was at home in it. It was unbelievable, but perhaps only the unbelievable could be believed. Perhaps the truth was always a lie. This is a paradigm for Ellison's achievement of an intricate verbal jazz. Playing just off the beat are the variations on a refrain, "Could he himself be both rind and heart?" and "Reinhardt the rounder," and "Rhine the rascal," triumphantly repeated. Ross, the exhorter, vivid and sympathetically portrayed by Ellison, is not a temptation for the Invisible Man, but the metaphoric Reinhardt, heartbreakingly and hilariously, is. Though Ellison's picaresque hero finally identifies Reinhardt's freedom with chaos rather than imagination, again, we may trust the tale and not the teller. Ross the Destroyer is a figure of sinister pathos, but still we are moved because in the background we can hear the jazz of Ross the Exhorter. What do we hear in Reinhardt's great music? It would be difficult to disengage Reinhardt from the contexts in which jazz originated. One might go further and mention Reinhardt's literary comrades, Villon, Marlowe, Rimbaud, major poets who were cutthroats, thieves, spies, runners. The Invisible Man accepts Reinhardt as context, but not as forerunner. There he chooses Louis Armstrong, who broke through context. Ellison, not quite willing to assert as much for himself, famously ends the novel by implicating the reader in the imagination of invisibility. Who knows but that, on the lower frequencies, I speak for you. Toni Morrison, Song of Solomon. Toni Morrison, born in 1931, is best known for her lyrical fantasy novel, Beloved, 1987. but I continue to prefer Song of Solomon, 1977, as her most permanent achievement to date. Though she has not yet surpassed it, she is very much at work, and so I will venture no prophecy as to her final eminence. Here I desire only to give a brief account of Song of Solomon, both for its own sake and because it shrewdly hints at a subtle critique of the tradition of Melville, Faulkner, and Ellison, which it joins, though warily and under protest, as befits the work of a self-proclaimed African-American Marxist and feminist. And yet, literary tradition chooses an authentic writer more than the other way around. Something also of Virginia Woolf's aestheticism lingers on in Morrison's style and vision, altogether, I think, to Morrison's benefit. Milkman Dead, the protagonist of Song of Solomon, quests for visibility in a clear reversal of Ellison's hero, and with the mingled gain and loss of coming a quarter century after Invisible Man. Morrison, commendably, is an immensely ambitious novelist who takes large artistic risks. Milkman, her near surrogate, is extraordinarily audacious, and becomes so incessant in his quest for his family's truth that pragmatically he must be judged doom-eager. It cannot be accidental that only 2 out of 6 protagonists discussed in this chapter, up to now, have proper or authentic family names. Darl Bundren and Oedipa Moss, and both of those are close to ideograms. The visionary Darl's family name is very much a burden to him, and the female Oedipus seeks truth wherever the Tristero leads her. Call me Ishmael, or Miss Lonely Hearts, or The Kid, or Invisible Man. Dead is not Milkman's true name. It turns out to be Shalimar, pronounced Shalimone or Solomon. Morrison, with her own visionary irony, uniquely gives us a hero who recovers his true name at the cost of no less than everything, his life included. As parable, this is powerful. How can you be yourself until you void others' misnaming of you? Born Chloe Anthony Wofford, the novelist changed her name to Tony, modifying Anthony while still an undergraduate. Milkman's best friend, or enemy brother, is called Guitar, and the book ends with them engaged in a death struggle. Yet Milkman, unlike Guitar, is spiritually redeemed. He has recovered family history, personal truth, and a heroic myth that of his ancestor Solomon Shalimar, who flew back to Africa without benefit of airplane to escape bondage. Morrison has an uncanny gift for fantasy. I find it becomes extravagant in Beloved, but aesthetically it is kept within limits in Song of Solomon. The reader, and this is Morrison's skill, never quite knows where reality and fantasy come into conflict in Milkman's story, which begins with a black insurance man's suicidal attempt at flight the day before the birth of baby Milkman, nursed at his mother's breast until he was 4. Also at 4, the child learned that unaided flight was impossible, and he lost all interest in himself. Weaned into an exasperated dullness, Milkman suffers his impossible parents, Macon dead, a slum landlord, and Ruth, who is deranged. It is fair to say of the young man Milkman Dead that he combines his father's rapacity and his mother's solipsism. He emulates Hamlet by goading his Ophelia, Hagar, to madness, coldly rejecting her. And since Hagar cannot bring herself to kill Milkman, she dies instead. After a vain drive to go beyond his father in financial greed, Milkman starts out upon another quest, which is the primary strength of Song of Solomon. He goes south to the ancestral Shalimar, where an astonishingly aged crone, Circe, narrates his family's true history to him. The return to Shalimar brings about a Circean metamorphosis in reverse, as Milkman painfully and slowly achieves his true inner form. Here, Morrison brilliantly parodies Faulkner's famous saga, The Bear, where Ike McCaslin is initiated into the hunt. Milkman undergoes the same ritual with a black difference, taking on the living heart of a slain bobcat. Transformed, Morrison's hero recovers his true Solomonic name and leaps courageously to his final death duel with Guitar. It is remarkable that Morrison is able to sustain her symbolic parable with such a wealth of social realism that the fantastic seems only another version of the everyday. Refusing to continue as an invisible man, the refound Solomon learns to make a surrender to the air, and so to ride upon it as his ancestor did. What makes Milkman's apotheosis persuasive is Morrison's sheer brio and her sure grasp of all her traditions. Commenting upon Song of Solomon with the polemical fervor of her fused ideologies, Morrison insists that her reader must ask the questions of a community and not of an individual. The reader, as narrator, asks the questions the community asks, and both reader and voice stand among the crowd, within it, with privileged intimacy and contact, but without more privileged information than the crowd has. The egalitarianism which places us all, reader, the novel's population, the narrator's voice, on the same footing, reflected for me the force of Flight and Mercy and the precious, imaginative yet realistic gaze of black people who, at one time anyway, did not mythologize what or whom it mythologized. The song itself contains this unblinking evaluation of the miraculous flight of the legendary Solomon. Morrison is certainly telling us why Song of Solomon should be read. But how can the solitary reader be true to herself if she does not ask her own questions rather than the community's? You can argue, if you wish, that we ought to read to socialize ourselves. But who then will decide whether what or whom is mythologized ought to have been? Morrison seems to argue that a black folk gaze could once mythologize and not mythologize simultaneously. I hear a totalizing ideology in that more than rational assertion, and I return to my opening contention in this book: to read in the service of any ideology is not to read at all. Fortunately, the earlier Morrison had not yet incarnated the spirit of the age, and Song of Solomon remains a spur to the quest of how to read and why. Summary Observations. The seven American novels discussed in this section, I've termed The School of Melville, since Moby Dick is their authentic starting point. As D.H. Lawrence observed, Moby Dick is an American apocalypse, a catastrophic vision of the American nation and its destiny. Faulkner, West, Pynchon, McCarthy, Ellison, and Morrison all are Melville's children, though Pynchon evades his inheritance, and Morrison argues that a hidden strand in Moby Dick concerns not just the whiteness of the whale, but the insane whiteness that excludes African Americans from Melville's overt vision. A reader might ask, what are the pleasures and self-enhancements to be gained from reading As I Lay Dying, or Blood Meridian, and indeed all of these post-Melvillian apocalypses? When novels become this difficult and this negative in their visions, do they still persuade us that there is a substance in us that prevails? The question holds for the best of current American fiction, aside from Pynchon and Morrison. Do the disasters of Philip Roth's brilliant Sabbath's Theater and poignant American pastoral or the sublime maelstrom of Don DeLillo's underworld somehow teach us how to live, what to do? What is the reader's use of apocalyptic fictions? Negativity cleanses, though at the high price of nihilism. At the close of Moby Dick, we are left with the great shroud of the sea, and the floating Ishmael, only another orphan. I do not think that there is a higher aesthetic achievement by a 20th-century American writer than As I Lay Dying, a work of shattering originality. But shattering is the most precise adjective for the effect of this novel upon me. Darl Bundren is Faulkner's surrogate, and the figure with whom the sensitive reader must identify. But Darl, an intuitive genius, follows the downward path not to wisdom, but to madness, the victim of an outrageously selfish father and a totally unloving mother. The Bundren's quest to bury their mother as she desired may be heroic, but it becomes a Mississippi apocalypse, a nightmare of fire and flood. Miss Lonely Hearts is a parody that must be acclaimed as great writing, yet its nihilistic rancidity is unparalleled since Shakespeare's Measure for Measure and Troilus and Cressida. Very little of America survives The Crying of Lot 49. We are given a choice between cultivating paranoia or practicing pseudo-anarchism. Ellison's Invisible Man, survivor of white hypocrisy and black apocalypticism, implies that he will return to ordinary life, but is still an underground man when last we see him. And Milkman Dead, Toni Morrison's most persuasive quester, ends locked in a death duel with his enemy brother, the terrorist Guitar. What kind of a self can be helped or augmented by living through these awesome negations of what ought still to be Walt Whitman's America? Deliberately, I have passed over the apocalypse of apocalypses, Blood Meridian, whose incessant frenzy of violence accurately depicts our past, frequently represents our gun-crazy present, and doubtless prophesies our bloody future. The United States, for two centuries now, has been obsessed with God and with guns, and neither fascination is likely to wane. We see around us the lineal descendants of the Glanton freebooters, heavily armed Aryan posses, shooters who break into children's centers and schools, exploders of federal buildings. The relevance of Cormac McCarthy is absolute. He is the Homer of our tragic epic of slaughter and religiosity. Judge Holden, as he promised, will never die, and right now the judge is dancing and fiddling somewhere out there in the western night. It is not the function of reading to cheer us up or to console us prematurely, but I conclude by affirming that all of these American visions of the end of our time offer us more, much more, than their cleansing negativity. Reread what is most worthy of rereading, and you will remember what strengthens your spirit. When I recall Moby Dick, I think first of the fraternal love between Ishmael and Queequeg, and then I respond again to the courageous defiance of Ahab's American Prometheanism. The final effect of the 6 Melvillian novels that follow is not nihilistic, but ambiguous, and in those ambiguities are embedded superb rewards for the reader's self. Ahab, Addie Bundren, Shrike, the anonymous agents of the Tristero, the malevolent Judge Holden, Ross the Exhorter Destroyer, Reinhardt the Runner and Reverend, and Guitar, constitute a nightmare panoply, but they do not eclipse for the reader the quests, however baffled, of Ishmael, Darl Bundren, Miss Lonely Hearts, Oedipa Moss, The Kid, Invisible Man, and Milkman Dead. There are survivors among these, Ishmael, Oedipa, Invisible Man. Why read? Because you will be haunted by great visions of Ishmael, escaped alone to tell us, of Edipa Moss, cradling the old derelict in her arms, of Invisible Man preparing to come up again like Jonah out of the whale's belly. All of them, on some of the higher frequencies, speak to and for you. Epilogue. Completing the work. Rabbi Tarfon said, "The day is short, and the work is great, and the laborers are sluggish, and the wages are abundant, and the master of the house is demanding." Rabbi Tarfon also used to say, "It is not necessary for you to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it." I first read the sayings of the fathers, Pirkei Avot, when I was a boy. And while I was struck by certain aphorisms of Hillel and Akiva, it was the apothegms of the less celebrated Tarfon that gave me the most lasting wounds. The sayings of the fathers constitute an epilogue added on to Tame the Mishnah, the great code of oral law, edited by Rabbi Judah the Patriarch around the year 200 of the Common Era. About 50 years later, the tractate of the Father's Wisdom Sayings was attached to the Mishnah, and from then to now it has been the one popular part of the great code of rabbinic law. The Sayings of the Fathers deliberately begins with a magnificent but historically dubious drum roll, affirming normative Judaism as a continuous tradition, thus legitimating the oral law. Moses received Torah from Sinai and delivered it to Joshua, and Joshua to the elders, and the elders to the prophets, and the prophets to the men of the great synagogue. These said three things: be deliberate in judging, and raise up many disciples, and build a fence about the Torah. Sinai there is a stand-in for Yahweh himself. We do not know where Mount Sinai was, and evidently the rabbis did not either. This simply does not matter. As for the great synagogue, that is mythology also. It appears to mean the followers of Ezra, the scribe, who may himself have been the great redactor who gave us the Hebrew scriptures as essentially we now have them, that is, as they were brought back from the Babylonian exile. Still, no one should wish to quarrel with the wisdom of "be deliberate in judging," though "raise up many disciples" is more problematical, and building a fence about the Torah seems to me quite a bad idea. Yet the sweeping grandeur of the opening of the Sayings of the Fathers remains poignant, whether persuasive or not. Rabbinical Judaism, which has now been normative for more than 1900 years, is no more or less belated a religion than Christianity is. Both resulted from the terrible catastrophe of the year 70 of the Common Era, when the Roman legions sacked Jerusalem and destroyed the second temple, the temple of Herod the Great. Where Yahweh went when he was expelled from the Holy of Holies, no one knows. Nor do we know the full range of versions of the religion of Judah that were current before the temple fell. The sages who escaped, with Roman indulgence, to the town Yavna, founded what we still call Judaism. Yavna itself went up in flames in 132 of the Common Era, when Rabbi Akiva, heroic, old, and perhaps sublimely mad, committed the dreadful mistake of joining the Bar Kokhba rebellion against the Romans. Akiva, whose religion can still be considered the definitive expression of normative Judaism, proclaimed Bar Kokhba as the Messiah. This disaster engendered a holocaust of the Jews exceeded in magnitude only by the Nazi terror, and concluded with the martyrdom of Akiva himself. About 120 years after this catastrophe, the sayings of the fathers quietly ignores it, and indeed dismisses all history as inconsequential when compared to the chain of tradition in which sage comes after sage and wisdom endures. The Second Temple was gone, the Academy of Yavne was gone, but the genealogy of normative tradition remained serene. What Donald Harmon Akenson rightly calls a great religious invention had been achieved. Yet we are now something like 1,750 years away from the sayings of the fathers. Does this grand invention retain more than antiquarian interest, particularly here in the United States, where Jews, Protestants, and Catholics begin to blend together in what I have called the American religion, an indigenous national faith that I suspect we do not yet begin to understand? I go back to my interest in Rabbi Tarfon, which has engrossed me for almost all the years of my life. Historically, we know little about Tarfon, particularly when we compare him to his contemporary, Akiva. Akiva was so strong and central a personality that we seemed to know him, but Tarfon is subsumed by the rabbinical texts, and we have to listen carefully to his sayings to get some notion of the inner man, who rarely agreed with Akiva on any disputed matter. Since Akiva's disciples invariably are our only source for these arguments, we can reasonably doubt their stories in which Tarfon is always bested. Unlike Akiva, who came out of the common people, Tarfon was a priest, a kind of archaic survival of the earlier time of the Second Temple. One of his prime concerns, therefore, was with the functions and privileges of priests, which did not interest Akiva at all. Where the two sages collided was on the fascinating question of subjective assumptions as against supposedly objective facts. In a way that reminds me of Sigmund Freud, Tarfon argued for the reality principle. The primacy of fact over intention is Tarfon's dominant idea. Deeds are all that are important, whether we meant to do them or not. Akiva argued, rather, that what we think and what we want must be taken into account in judging our deeds. The sayings of the fathers assigns to Akiva this eloquent formulation: silence is a fence for wisdom. All is foreseen, and free will is given, and the world is judged by goodness, and all is according to the amount of work. One hears a family resemblance here to Tarfon. Neither rabbi would have agreed with Jesus that whosoever looks after a woman with lust in his heart has as good as committed adultery with her. But the shadings of difference between Akiva and Tarfon are subtle and important. In Tarfon, the rabbi never quite replaced the priest. But in Akiva, the nostalgia for the temple has yielded to the Mishnah, to the oral law. Akiva therefore urges the primacy of the will, and insists that we are what we will to be. Tarfon discounts the will, remembering always the strict discipline of the Second Temple. We are judged by how much goodness we have performed, Akiva says, and adds inventively, and all is according to the amount of work. But to Tarfon, the day is short and the work endless, and we tend to be sluggish laborers. The Yahweh of the temple is demanding, since the wages of his covenant are high. They are the blessing of more life on into a time without boundaries. If Tarfon were always so fierce, I too would prefer Akiva, but Tarfon also used to say, "It is not necessary for you to complete the work, but neither are you free to desist from it." Whether one is normative or heretical, Jewish or Christian, secularist or skeptic, Tarfon's wisdom is eternally useful. I go on writing and teaching, as I have these 45 years, and I keep returning to Tarfon's formulation. If it were necessary for any among us to complete the work, then we might break off in despair, because the work can never be completed. The temple cannot be redeemed, and reality testing always must end in the absolute primacy of fact, which is the death of each individual. Why, if the work cannot be completed, are we not free to desist from it? To answer that is not a simple matter, particularly since the greatest of all writers, Shakespeare, did desist from his marvelous labor of reinventing both the English language and human personality. It fascinates and saddens me that Shakespeare gave up writing after his collaboration with John Fletcher on The Two Noble Kinsmen in 1613. Shakespeare was just 49, and he lived another 3 years, mostly in retirement at Stratford-on-Avon. Perhaps illness dimmed Shakespeare's final years, but the Shakespearean parts of The Two Noble Kinsmen show a new style and a new consciousness which should have been developed. In the remainder of this epilogue, I want to contrast Shakespeare's abandonment of the work with Tarfon's insistence that we are not free to abandon it. Shakespeare had been rereading Chaucer's The Knight's Tale from the Tales of Canterbury, so as to borrow freely from Chaucer for his plot. The knight sums up Chaucer's ironic ethos in one grim couplet. "It is full fair a man to bear him even, for all day meeteth men at unset Stephen." My old friend, the late Chaucerian Talbot Donaldson, paraphrased this superbly. "It is a good thing for a man to bear himself with equanimity, for one is constantly keeping appointments one never made." Chaucer's Stoic Knight is a universe of discourse away from Akiva and Tarfon, but he doesn't so much contradict them. Instead, he offers a secular alternative. "Bear yourself with equanimity, for you will go out from here to live a life in which you will constantly find yourself keeping appointments that you never made." Does it matter whether one is required to complete the work, or whether one is free to desist from the work, if you must meet a final appointment that certainly you did not make? Is bearing yourself with equanimity sufficient? Is Stoic composure or uniformity of response enough? Shakespeare, desisting from the work with the final lines of The Two Noble Kinsmen, gentles Chaucer, yet seems also to see that equanimity has to be enough, unless we can become like children again, or more happily, have remained like them. O you heavenly charmers, what things you make of us! For what we lack, we laugh. For what we have, are sorry. Still are children in some kind. Let us be thankful for that which is, and with you leave dispute that are above our question. Let's go off and bear us like the time." These enigmatic lines, the last serious poetry that Shakespeare wrote, are a long way off from Tarfon, or from Jesus, for that matter. Those heavenly charmers are supposed to be the planets Venus and Mars, and Moon as Diana. But Shakespeare is being rather more whimsical, even as he abandons the work. "Learn to laugh for what you lack," he tells us, "and be sorry for what you have. But keep the laughter and the sorrow light, as a child should." Silence may be another fence around Scripture, and being equable may help you keep appointments you never made. But bearing yourself like the time seems to mean take what time remains pretty much as it comes. Normative tradition, Judaic, Christian, Islamic, secular, will tell you, as Tarfon does, that Yahweh's work is not to be abandoned, even though you cannot complete it. Shakespeare, who is the secular scripture, tells you to bear yourself like the time, which means that a time comes when you desist from the work. At 69, I do not know whether Tarfon or Shakespeare is right. And yet, though the moral decision cannot be made merely by reading well, the questions of how to read and why are more than ever essential to help us decide whose work to perform.
The End. You've been listening to How to Read and Why by Harold Bloom, narrated by John McDonough. And thank you for being a Recorded Books reader.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.